Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, remember me? And this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know, and I'm back. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and I know you have missed me as much as I have missed you. The reality is, I took a little hiatus, a holiday hiatus, and I'd like to say that I was traveling the world visiting my friends in the UK and Europe, but I wasn't. Turns out that being the CEO of a company is a full-time job, and I already had a full-time job. I already had two. So making the most out of trying to juggle Dutches and clients and people for the podcast, you know, getting guests, recording it, editing it, marketing it, launching it. I have a new Substack. Thank you very much. I'm really enjoying it. It's called Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. It's going really well. And so writing that. And of course, the group has almost 40,000 members now. I'm pretty active there. And then I have all the little moving parts of Healthy Gut Girl and Ona's. Some exciting news with Ona's. I have been really working hard on trying to find ways to upgrade our product, find better vendors. I think there's some kind of, I don't know, campaign against progesterone going on in the world that's a little bit of a hush-hush. And I think they're really focusing on pushing estrogen and kind of sweeping progesterone under the rug, relying on only progestins and making it harder for compounders and people who manufacture progesterone products to get a hold of micronized progesterone. A lot of pharmacies are having shortages as well, so I know something's going on. And then there's also interesting things going on with the vitamin E production around the world. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but a lot of vendors have suspended manufacturing altogether. And so, you know, we don't want to just use any old vitamin E. There's a lot of things that tick the boxes for what I want in the product. And Luna Oil is a really popular product. So we want to make sure that we have a vendor who ticks all the boxes, but is also available. Even things packaging, even things like pumps and bottles and everything is, it's interesting how much harder it is to deal with those things since COVID. I have a new product also. So we're upgrading the Luna Oil 10%. We're increasing its absorbability. Excuse me. We're increasing its absorbability. We're getting some black bottles that are going to be more protective of the oil, going to protect the oil better. Even though the oil is quite stable, it's still going to be nice to have that added protection. And the droppers are going to have calibration on them, so you can see how many milliliters you're getting per drop and in your dose. And then we're going to have a proprietary ingredient, although it is listed. But it's just going to help absorption, help keep the progesterone in dissolution. So it doesn't crystallize, it doesn't come out of dissolution, and it makes it easier to absorb. And there's some studies that go along with this to support that that notion. And that's exciting. So we've been, my partner's been doing a lot of digging on just making it more absorbable, because that seems to be the issue for everyone. And then I had a little selfish indulgence, which is that I am one of those people that doesn't do well with the higher strengths. So I don't do well with 10 and 20%. And I'm not crazy about the oil, because I personally just don't like the flavor of any of the oils. I don't like Progest E. I don't like Luna Oil flavor. I just, it's gag to me. It's just, and so I decided to add a flavor. I picked spearmint for a reason, specific reason. One is that it's fresh, it's refreshing. It cuts through the sort of bitterness of the sunflower oil. It cuts through that. But it also is really good for digestion If you're going to use it topically, it feels really good. It's a carminative. That's an herbal action that helps to get rid of bloating and gas pains and gas. So you can put it in your belly button. I tried it vaginally and it's tingly. It doesn't burn. It's not very, it's very mild. There's less than, I think, less than 0.20 mLs per bottle, which is not a lot at all. So it's a mild, mild spearmint flavor and it's all natural. And so, yay. And I love it. And I hope you guys will love it too. And it's 5%. It's not 10%. So it's easier to absorb for many women. And my guest today mentions that you can't use spearmint if you're taking homeopathics. And I don't know exactly why that is, but maybe I'll look it up and have the answer in the outro. So there you have that one reason why someone might not be able to use it. But there's so many options. We have 3%, 5%, 10%, 20%, and we have liquids and we have oils you can use on your gums. We have serums, we have creams. I mean, if you can't find what you need at Ona's, I don't know what to tell you. You can send me an email and say, hey, can you make some cough drops? I don't know. You can send me what you think you'd like to have. Okay. And we'll think about it. So today I thought we would come back with our new, it's not really a new season, but we'll come back from my hiatus with one of my favorite guests. And she kind of came on as an emergency guest. It's pharmacist Carol Peterson. And she reached out to me just a few weeks ago and sent me an incredible study, article/study that was done by Mark Newman. So she mentions Mark Newman in the podcast. He is the creator of the Dutch test. And he's awesome. I love him. He's really, really great. But the study doesn't have the best things to say about progesterone cream. So she sent me a study that was done and also his statement that he put out to everyone. And then she met with her group of people, her group of experts, and they had this big powwow and it exploded. It got very exciting. And then she sent me an email and she wanted me to know all about it and her thoughts on it. So I'm super happy to have her today to talk about this with us. And that she thought about us at all is just awesome. She mentioned some things that you might be a little bit... that might be a little foreign to you. Well, she mentions Mark Newman. I just told you who he is. She talks a little bit about mass spec. So mass spec is a type of testing that they use. And so that's what she's talking about when she talks about how delicate the testing is and how complex it is. So when you're wondering, wait a minute, you know, she starts to get a little clinical and it's like, what is she talking about? And basically, it's called metabolite analysis. They use mass spectrometry. Oh, I can't even say it. Mass spectrometry. Spectrometry. That's the type of analysis, chemical analysis they use to test hormones in the Dutch and other forms of testing like Georgie Dinkoff's steroid analysis and whatnot. Okay, and then she talks about... aldosterone. And I wanted to mention aldosterone. And I might do a podcast with Constantine on this because he's really good about this and blood pressure and, you know, the reason that birth control pills are so bad and how it's so bad for blood pressure. And she talks about aldosterone and progesterone. Aldosterone is a stress hormone. So that's something that you need to remember. And there's different camps that believe that aldosterone raises estrogen and other camps that believe that it lowers estrogen. I think it's the estrogen that raises the aldosterone and that contributes to high blood pressure. But we talk about that a little bit. It also increases aromatase activity. So when you have high aldosterone, helps or it forces testosterone to convert into estrogen. So it's no two ways about it. Aldosterone is a stress hormone. Okay, so we talk about that. And then let's revisit some other things after she tells us all about this exciting news. And I will talk to you on the outside. Let's just jump right into the meat and potatoes because this is exciting and wacky. First of all, thank you for thinking of me and sending this to me, coming on in such short notice. For the listeners who have no idea what this is even about, why don't you tell them how you came about this info? What happened?
So David Rosensweet has a hormone group, and I'm on the board there. And somebody forwarded to him a statement prepared by Mark Newman, who ha has the Dutch test. And Mark is proposing in that statement that we should not be using progesterone on the skin because it doesn't show up very well in serum nor in urine, as he's saying. And therefore, we don't know if there's enough progesterone being used to protect the endometrium, which is it's in conventional medicine, it seems to be a big red flag, like progesterone only protects the endometrium. And that's why you should use it. Otherwise, you don't need it at all. There's this kind of prevailing situation. And that led to quite a heated bit of discussion within that group. But I thought you would like to see it because, of course, Onas is topical. And a lot of women and people in general, they like to see that tests tell them something, that they have a number or they have an indication. And tests can be useful, but it also can be very misleading. And so when I sent that over, you asked me what I thought. So I shared with what I talked about in the group. And we really do not have anything to use oral either, to show that there's a luteal phase. Let's say you use oral, you use serum, it goes up, it goes down. So if you measure your serum 12 hours later, it's gone. So does that mean you haven't protected your uterus? Does it mean when you just did get to a luteal level, maybe 3 or 4 hours after your last dose, does that mean you protected your uterus? Do we have any data at all that if you reach a certain amount as an excretion molecule in urine, that we have protected the uterus? We have zero for any of the tests that we are protecting the uterus. It got a little heated so much. One of the MDs in the group said, I'm leaving this group because I have to do what my board or North American Menopause Society does. And they'll say, oh, well, oral progesterone protects the uterus. And I would say sometimes it doesn't either. It really depends on the needs for a particular patient. And it's a really difficult concept for people to understand that it can be so variable with the needs for progesterone, depending on the situation, how you've eaten, if you had a glass of wine, what was your stressors for the day? It's totally treatable, all this stress and anxiety and stuff with progesterone. But it might vary from day to day to day, and it's a hard concept in conventional medicine to listen to your body.
That's the big thing, right?
And give patients some authority over what they're doing. So, for example, I love to tell patients, women, men too, to use anxiety as a marker for using enough progesterone for their needs. But having said that, do I have any evidence that if you reach comfort, having treated your anxiety, do you also protect the uterus? I don't know. I have no way to prove that. You have to do that patient by patient by patient. If there's some possibility that you're building up tissue, you've got to go get an ultrasound or an endometrial biopsy, which I'm not really in favor of, but that's the test that'll show you if you're having unusual buildup or not. So you can't depend on hormone marker to tell you that. So what Mark Newman was proposing that we throw out and not use progesterone ever on the skin for lack of showing up on a test, that's craziness. So in the meantime, I came across a couple other studies. I'll shoot them over to you later because I haven't completely digested it. But one was doing some studies on how progesterone was metabolized in kidney and intestinal tissue. And this was with oral progesterone. One of the references was a paper done in Germany that I just downloaded, going through different routes of administration. One of the points that's in this paper is that there are 30, maybe more, metabolites of
Wow.
progesterone. So, what happens with all those metabolites? And one of the interesting thing was for one sort of tissue in the study, and this was done in a cell culture of this tissue, rat tissue, and human tissue actually. Transfers to in vivo in 2 to 4 minutes, progesterone had disappeared and had gone to all the metabolites. So, if we're only measuring limited number of metabolites, like in urine, they tend to measure 2, or 1 sometimes, or we're only measuring progesterone, then we're not really understanding or have any idea, any clue where it all went and what it's doing. And so that raises some very, very interesting questions. So I think your best bet is still to rely on clinical response. There's no doubt that when you use progesterones and creams, they work. There's no doubt the oral works, no doubt the vaginal works. The hormone is the thing. And you have to get it in somehow. Your body has to have the advantage of having it. And I think we know so little about the effects at receptors. I just heard a lecture at A4M, and they were talking, this one speaker was talking about the integrity of the membrane being an issue that impairs your ability for hormones to do their thing via some receptor or some other process that the health of the cell could be an impediment. We really haven't looked at that very much. So it's a jungle.
You had mentioned some things to me when we talked last after I got my tissue stuff back, and we kind of ended our conversation with we still don't know anything. But so a couple of things. One is, so the doctor who left, she left because she felt like she didn't like the idea that people were still defending and considering supplementing topical estrogen, I mean progesterone, knowing that it didn't protect the uterus now that Mark Newman said so. And she got upset and said, "You guys, I'm not going to work with you anymore. I'm not going to be in this group anymore because I don't think it's right that we're treating women with topical progesterone." And she left, right?
Well, I don't know.
Basically.
Maybe she'll be coaxed back. We'll see what Dr. Rosensweet does, but that was essentially what
Interesting.
she said.
Sounds like I would have liked to have been on a fly on the wall for that conversation. Okay, and then Mark Newman. So I really like him. I think he does a very good job of explaining things, and I've always enjoyed him. I've learned so much from him about the Dutch. But my feeling on this, if it matters at all, is that he's protecting himself because there's so many variables with women when they use it. And Dutch is getting so popular, and people are relying on just the Dutch to make diagnoses, and to especially doctors to make these broad statements about their hormones. And I feel like maybe he's protecting himself because he's like, look, I don't want to be the testing company that says Yes, he wants to be up front and say, look, we're not seeing it. So my guess is I wouldn't rely on it to for treatment. Do you think that's a possibility?
Possibility, but I think he's going to experience the same problem with endorsing oral. Now we have the advantage, we have oral progesterone as an FDA approved product. But I believe for the most part, doctors who are using that are underdosing that often too. For some reason, it's gotten into the public domain, if you will, that 100 milligrams orally or 200 milligrams orally are pretty good. But Dr. Jerry Lynn Pryor, whose big issue is protecting the bones, she doesn't use less than 300 milligrams orally. Well, how do you show that too? You've got to watch the bone remodeling tests, or I don't like the bone density tests. I think they're misleading, but you can at least do the tests that show if you are making new bone or you're depleting your bone. Those tests are available. So that would seem to me an obvious thing to do. Use progesterone and track that bone metabolism. So that would be the test. The bone metabolism will show if your dose is adequate. Is it adequate, that dose adequate for everybody? Maybe not. Maybe not.
So the other thought I was having was, I noticed being in this space, in the public space with all of this as a, I don't know, practitioner slash podcaster, that something that's become really obvious to me is in the last year to 2 years, I think ever since the debunking of the Women's Health Initiative happened, all of a sudden it seems like this huge push towards estrogen and the Marina coil to protect the uterus. So progestins coupled with estrogen. And I mean, I'm seeing people like Sarah Gottfried and people who are really big in the space, famous, respected doctors who are all of a sudden really pushing for it. And that they speak of progesterone very little, if at all. They don't speak of it in terms of like, well, we think it's the balance of the two, whether you have high or low levels that is protecting the uterus, but rather is estrogen and then progestins that are going to do this. And it just seems like almost like a marketing thing that's going on. I'm shocked at the people who are like really, even Dr. Rosensweet was going really gung-ho about the debunking of the Women's Health Initiative. So that's two separate things that I'm saying. But one, the first is, do you agree with me about this huge push from the NHS and from pharma towards estrogen?
It's coming from someplace, and I follow a couple other Facebook groups more than yours.
How
So,
dare you?
but one in particular is this one woman. It's like telling the whole group, and she sounds very authoritative. She's not really got a medical degree or anything, but claims she works in a clinic. And it's estrogen, estrogen, estrogen. And for every symptom that we would correlate with progesterone, she says it's low estrogen. And if you're not satisfied with the dose you're on, you need to use more estrogen. And this is getting women. I wonder if she's a troll, actually, is since you brought up this thing in conventional medicine, could she actually be a troll pushing this agenda along and trying to be an influencer in this group? That's why I seriously thought that there might be something like that going on. And if you do promote estrogen, estrogen, and that imbalance gets worse and worse, we know what women end up with. They end up with sleepers, they end up with hypertensive drugs, they end up with anxiety drugs, antidepressant drugs. They're a big boon for the pharmaceutical industry. To push this estrogen agenda and then somehow at the same time minimize the impact of what progesterone needs to do, which is truly, truly amazing. And I've been doing this for so long. like well over 30 years now, and I continue to be amazed at the new things I learn all the time about what's going on with progesterone. It's unlimited as far as I'm concerned. The amount of knowledge we don't have what we could learn. And so I don't know what the answer is, except for you know your body and see if it works for you, and see if the higher doses work. I've been coaching women. I've now so far I've only had two I lost. Why did I lose it? Because they didn't listen to a word I said. I said, when you start progesterone, if you need more, if your anxiety worsens, you've got to get over that. And I love your estrogen kickback term, for lack of anything else, because it's very descriptive of what it feels like. And I'm thinking there's probably an adrenaline issue in that estrogen kickback too, that there's too much adrenaline going on with some of the heart palpitations and the severe panic. But nonetheless, you can moderate that with progesterone. You just have to use enough. And the latest one was a woman. She was prescribed like a 200 milligram vaginal insert, and then I think she had Onas cream and used like a 50 milligram dose, and was a mess because I went over carefully over and over again. You have to use more till you overcome this. And so she stopped and she said, "No, I can't do this." Obviously we disagree. And so she hasn't had the pleasure of really experiencing the good progesterone can do for you. And I don't know what else. I'm thinking that there is something else going on in training women to believe progesterone is somehow dangerous. And they'll gladly go to a Klonopin and a Valium and whatever, which I think is far more dangerous, and not explore the use of progesterone because they are afraid.
Yeah, and I can't fault them for being afraid. Like, I feel bad because I was there. I was there, and I had if I hadn't been at literally like at the end of my rope of having seen plenty of some of the best doctors in Los Angeles, if I hadn't been on every possible supplement and every possible pain med, if I hadn't done all those things and been at a point where I was like, I've got nowhere to go now, nowhere to go. All I had was Ray White's progesterone therapy website. That's it.
I remember
I had no
that.
doctor. I had nobody to help me. There was no estrogen dominance support group. There was no influencer to tell me. And my husband, who kept saying in the on this website, it says if a symptom comes up, it's best to go up in dose. And I mean, I was having suicidal ideation. I was having things I'd never in my life had. Like, I was on 200 milligrams and I was like, oh my God, I don't want to live anymore. And then I would up my dose, and then I'd wake up with melasma darkened on my head, and I'm like crying, and my husband's like, go up in dose, rub it into the melasma. And every day it was something new, and I was like, oh God, I can't do this. And my husband's like, you have to. And if I didn't have that, I think I would have quit too, and I probably would have, who knows, lupus and who knows, probably bedridden now, if I had not listened to him and to Ray White's info. So I get the fear, and I get that it's paralyzing. And now with the group, I see it. I see women in the group who are scaring each other and who are getting mad at me because I'm gaslighting them, because I'm saying something's being overlooked. And they're saying, oh, well, what? I can't have an allergy. I'm like, yeah, you can, but the chances are you don't, So, and they don't want to hear that. And I don't blame them. I don't judge them. I just feel sorry because I feel like, gosh, if they could get past this.
I
But
know.
let, yeah.
Breaks my
But,
heart.
So let's go back to the thing about the metabolites. I find this super interesting, and the possibility of maybe one of those metabolites, you said how many? 50? What did you say?
30.
30 metabolites that we don't even know, we haven't even named. So
Well,
maybe.
they've named them, but who checks for them? Nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody.
And who
Although
knows what they do?
one of the little phrases I read that they were trying to investigate, I think that was in the kidney tissue, that progesterone was such a powerful counter to aldosterone near mineral balancer, that they were surprised that there wasn't more of this going on. But when they looked at kidney tissue and saw all these metabolites, they felt like going to this particular metabolite was sort of moderating that effect on aldosterone that progesterone could have. So there you have one instance exactly that. So if we have somebody with aldosterone issues, maybe we shouldn't be looking at progesterone molecule, then we should be looking at that metabolite. There's another thing here. At A4M, ZRT announced that they were going to do LC mass spec on blood spot and saliva. I go, what ho,
That's
like how is this going to pan out? So why I want to bring that up is that LC mass spec is a testing procedure that gives you the exact molecule. The other immunoassays, whether enzyme-induced assay, radioimmune assay, I don't know which is used by ZRT, but it's imperfect because it can bleed over into other hormones that it just tests a part of the structure. And if you look on, say, look at Wikipedia or something, you look at the steroidal cascade, you'll see how similar in structure all these hormones are. So when it bleeds over into another hormone, so you're measuring some of that. So then it makes me wonder, with saliva and blood spot and serum too, unless they are doing LC mass spec, some companies are and some are not. You should check and see how your test was analyzed. If you have the exact molecule or you don't have the exact molecule. So consider this. So just imagine you have the 30 metabolites of progesterone. Are some of those metabolites coming through on that immunoassay that won't be coming through as a measurement when you switch to LC mass spec?
Interesting.
So there's a kind of maybe a negative to this absolute precision.
Yeah. Well, I wonder also because I remember my partner at Ona saying that it's really difficult to tell the difference between DHEA and testosterone molecule. They're almost identical. And that's interesting. And then also the progesterone and progestin molecule is like tiny, tiny little difference, but obviously, the difference that it can do in your body is,
Can be
do or
huge.
die. Yeah. And then also, so these metabolites, that's so interesting because I think I read a study about the kidneys being like a progesterone machine. Like it was something about, it was a very good article. I'm sure you've seen it or study. But it makes me wonder maybe one of these progesterone metabolites is like a signaling molecule for adrenaline in some way, like you were saying. And how could we possibly know that unless they studied every single one of them and knew what they
Right.
did in every person?
That's exactly right. How do we know? Yeah. So there's so much unknown, yet I don't think it detracts from the reality that we can use this as a therapy and it does us a lot of good. So back to the clinical responses, everything. The other important thing, as you brought up with the estrogen, is I think in society or whatever, too many symptoms that women have are being touted as estrogen deficient symptoms, and they're not. Hot flashes, for one. My theory about hot flashes is from Premarin. Premarin got a approval. Their first approval was for vasomotor symptoms. But Premarin is not just estrogen. Now, they've identified 60 steroids in Premarin, and they still
Whoa.
haven't identified all of them. And there are some progesterone-like ones in there, and some testosterone-like ones there. And mainly, those 60 are not human identical, but they are having an impact. So you might look at Premarin. It seems to be like an estrogen dominant producing situation. We know that from some of its behavior. But those other steroids are moderating things, and maybe one of those other steroid hormones were more responsible. Maybe the progesterone-like ones were more responsible for the vasomotor symptoms. We know it occurs early in perimenopause. Hot flashes start early, and estrogen hasn't really dropped yet. And Jerry Lynn Pryor has now published a study with progesterone and vasomotor symptoms. They disappear with progesterone, yet hot flash seems to equal estrogen in the public's mind. Would you agree?
Yeah, oh my gosh, it's like I hear it every day. That's interesting. So what is your theory that happens? What do you think is triggering it? Is you think it's like the drop in progesterone and it's creating some kind of nitric oxide release that causes the histamine response or something like that?
And I think it's tied up into the adrenal glands as well, whipping around with adrenaline, and maybe a lack of hydrocortisone at those moments, or really excessive adrenaline. And I was very interested to see, this is also new to me, and not that long ago, was that methylation is a major detoxer for adrenaline. There are other detox mechanisms, but how many, when you work with women, they have high homocysteine, or they've been tested genetically and have MTHFR. They say about 40% of the population does have some impediment in methylation. I don't know if that's 100% true or not. People are arguing it at medical meetings with one is significant or the other one, or what's the issue? But the long and the short of it, you get a big boost of adrenaline, and then you can't get rid of it. It's persistent. You can't get rid of it. The other thing that was kind of a clue to me with this too is a colleague of mine said she had a client that was on a continuous glucose monitor. And she documented whenever she had a hot flash, her blood glucose dropped to 50. So to put this in perspective, like 80 is 60 to 80 is a pretty good fasting glucose, but you would have much more with a meal. So if you're dropping into that whole very low blood glucose state, that of course ramps up your adrenal glands and sets this whole kind of activity.
Emergency responses in motion, which
Yes.
can include the nitric oxide release and all of those things that come that people think are so good, like serotonin and nitric oxide and these things we think they're great, but they're emergency responses to something else. So yeah, that's really interesting. I feel like from this whole tissue test that I did, it's so interesting to me because I think it has something to do that something in there, like maybe as we start to get into perimenopause and menopause, the estrogen's starting to go into the tissues because progesterone is dropping and that balance is gone. And then that tissue estrogen, maybe this adrenaline response creates histamine because it really is such a skin, hot flashes are so tied in with your actual, like, feels like a fever, and your whole body gets this like feverish feeling, like in the tissues. And it's not your core temperature that's heating up, right?
No,
It's not.
it
So,
isn't. Not a
yeah. So that
bit.
makes me think tissue, tissue, tissue. And it also, a lot of us women reach this point where the chin hair thing, where these, they're not, and I don't even want to call them hairs. They're like wires. They're like goat hairs, And I'm like, what is it that's happening in this on this chin in this tissue, right?
I read Anne Louise Gettleman in one of her books actually had that. Those hairs were from one of the DHEA or testosterone metabolites, and progesterone should overcome it. I don't think so. My clinical
No,
experience.
no. I
Here's
think,
another clinical response. That doesn't work. So
yeah.
what's something else is triggering that, and how that happens? We don't know. You could probably
Yeah.
get a PhD with solving that.
I know. You'd be a very wealthy person if you could do that. But what I notice with mine is they're also quite cystic. So, like, it's you just don't pluck it and it's just not done. There's actually like a type of cystic fluid in there with it. So this inflammation is what it is. So there's this aromatization that's happening with your testosterone, is my guess. I know I have a much more simplified way of looking at these things because your brain is way more well, you've studied it, and I have not, at least not to that degree. But it seems like it's being the aromatization is happening and turning it into estrogen and growing things, growing hair, growing, the tissue there. And it's inflammatory. But if that were true, why isn't progesterone making it go away when I rub it into that area?
I use progesterone on my face all the time, and I still get hairs. I don't
Mm-hmm.
have a lot, but they're persistent.
Oh, you
They
don't need many.
don't
You just need like three that your husband goes, "What the heck is that?"
And
Well,
they can grow an inch overnight.
yeah, it's wild.
Where did that come from?
So, okay, let's go back a little bit and talk about, if you don't mind, talking about the Women's Health Initiative, just because a lot of women don't really know. And I have a question about it. So it's just this massive, the largest study ever done, apparently, on any group of women, on hormones. And they were,
Prospective.
okay.
So they planned in advance rather than ask people what they did, which is
Okay.
always dicey.
Okay, it's entrapment. So that right away you say is a good enough reason for it to be dicey and maybe not legitimate to some degree. But what happened? Because, well, tell us what the study was, if you will.
So it had several branches, actually. One was just on nutrition, which you rarely hear about. But so the main arms were progesterone, no progesterone, sorry, Premarin only if you had no uterus, because of course your uterus doesn't need protecting anymore because it's not there. And then if you did have a uterus, you got Premarin and medroxyprogesterone, or Prempro is the brand name. So it's basically these arms, and they did have a control group with nothing at all. And I know there was this nutrition branch, but they started they planned to go 5 years totally, and they stopped early. One was because of breast cancer concerns, and the other was cardiovascular concerns. And
Because the women were getting in the tests were getting breast cancer and heart disease.
where the ideal outcome of this would be you're protected. These hormone-like things would be protective. And so these two sections stopped early. They've gone back, and that is the genesis of, oh, it wasn't really happening in the younger group, 50 to 60 or something like that. And then they had decades. So taking Premarin if you were younger wasn't as much of a cancer risk as when you were older. And then since then, they've published some retractions that this risk was overstated, and bad analysis of the numbers shouldn't have been stopped, et cetera. So we still don't know for sure from that group of things. And then Cardiovascular thing. Premarin, there was a study done earlier, and I'd really have to hunt for it because it was highly used to push the estrogen Premarin picture. And what they were saying was that the estrogens dilated the blood vessels feeding the heart, so that's where it was getting its cardiac protectiveness. And so they did this rather big study with Premarin. And it touted that Premarin estrogen was cardioprotective. However, when I got the study and read the whole thing, about page seven of a box with the symptoms and whatever and numbers. And what really threw me was Premarin, the w women with Premarin had 2.5 times higher risk of stroke.
Whoa.
Now, how is that not a cardiovascular problem, right? You didn't see it in the title, the abstract, the discussion, and this was a highly referenced article. They were always talking about it. Other studies were referring to it. So they already knew that Premarin was not cardioprotective. This is garbage that they, of course, the drug company, Wyeth Ayers was deep into helping fund all of this as well. So they knew these things, and they knew medroxyprogesterone acetate produces like strokes too. They knew it. So to expect a different outcome, unless they thought maybe if we get a bigger group of women than our previous smaller tests, maybe the signal would be smaller. I'm just theorizing. So we have a big, massive study really giving women toxic substances. And now it's like we're going to base our whole everything we think about hormones on this study. And then you have groups. This is how corrupt science has become. We have groups like American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, North American Menopause Society, the Endocrine Society. They meet in little groups. And they say, well, if it's true for this estrogen, i.e., Premarin, it's true for all estrogens. And they do the same with progesterone. If it's true for this progestin, it's also true of progesterone. And once in a while, I rather sarcastically say, somebody gets this crap from the doctor they're saying, I say, Did your doctor pass his physiology course, his biochemistry course? Is your doctor at the bottom of the class? I don't know. Because it has, no basis in reality that we have these committees doing this. So they're warning us away from progesterone because of the progestins, and they warned us away from estrogen. Is estradiol as big a problem as Premarin? I don't think so. Personally, I don't think so. And if you look, you start doing some deeper dives on smaller studies, it would appear so. We also got this series of studies done with oral progesterone, oral estrogen, which was Premarin, opposing the other side was estradiol in gels or patches, which were both FDA approved. And so we had this thing given to us that, oh, or oral estrogen is causing more fibrinogen, clotting, more C-reactive protein, inflammation, more sex hormone binding globulin creates a binding problem for your androgens, DHEA, testosterone. So all these things, they're a whole thing. But what we know only is that Premarin causes that. We don't know that estradiol will do the same thing. And I even went so far as to call the manufacturer. There's a brand name, Estrace, which is oral estradiol. Why couldn't they do Premarin oral versus estradiol oral? Why are they publishing this crap? And so also embedded into the whole thing is no, you can never use estrogens orally. You've got to use topical. because oral estrogen is dangerous. But I'm going to say, is it oral estradiol or is it oral Premarin that's dangerous? As we didn't do that study, Premarin versus estradiol. I have done as deep a dive as I could in the literature in that, and it was either estradiol did not cause those problems, or it was equivocal. And I even called the drug company and got nowhere with this medical expert who couldn't seem to understand what I was asking.
Medical
So,
expert.
I know. So we have this in the vernacular. Is this maybe this one's not so harmful, but it's like dogma out there. I probably had people say, so is there something wrong with oral estradiol? I don't
Yeah. It
I don't
sounds like
think.
a similar issue with the progesterone, progestin, like you said, that they've demonized all progesterone because of progestins. Let's say, what is that new meme going around, like where they say, don't blame salt for what sugar has done. Don't blame progesterone for what progestins have done, and don't blame
Oh,
estradiol for what Premarin has done. Oh, I'm gonna have to post
yeah,
that.
post that. That's great because it's right on point. Do you know your what is it, Prop 65 or whatever in California where they require that you put a label on progesterone products warning you about cancer dangers? I looked into that with a customer who lived in California, and she was outraged about this and wanted to do something, at least politically. And so, in the course of doing this, I got all 80 studies that they used to as a basis of creating that declaration that progesterone causes cancer, and all 80 studies had no progesterone at all, only progestins.
All 80 studies.
And so we asked the bureaucracy section of the California government to review it again, and they refused.
Yeah, California is a joke. It really is a joke. But I also wanted to say that, with the estrogen thing, after this test that I had done, all these tests, which I'm still trying to figure out how to get, like a buccal. Georgie was trying to get somebody to order me a buccal swab for steroid analysis. But I asked Dr. Mashgadi and I asked a couple of other people, and they were like, "Yeah, we can't do that. Like, you can order a buccal swab for other things, but then that would just be like a saliva test." You can order a vaginal swab and use it buccally, but that's only going to be for issues related to uterine and cervical issues, not steroid test. Do you agree with that? Do you have any input on that?
Yes. If a lab is offering such a test, it's quite an ordeal to put something like that together. And they have to, their analysis equipment has to be calibrated for the range of hormones you'd expect to be in there. So you have to make sure that your equipment is proper for that particular range that can occur in there. And then you essentially have to test the test for accuracy. It's a huge endeavor to put
Expensive
something
too.
like that together. So for example, they have to manipulate, I think they have to manipulate urine samples for make dilutions to go down to where their analysis equipment can handle the concentration, but that's part of the calculation. And that's all been done, and it's a big work. So,
Yeah, so we're kind of came to the end of our road with this, I think. I mean, I'm still willing to do a breast, like I know it's invasive, but when I went into menopause, I immediately started getting fibrotic breasts, and just, like it was clear they were just dense. And I said, that's estrogen, and they were tender. And I said, that's just estrogen. And I was willing to say, okay, well, let's do a biopsy and check it out. But you can't find a doctor to be able to do a biopsy on a healthy person's breast. So we kind of came to the end of our road with that. But he was really, he did my toenail. He ended up doing toenails as well. And it was equally 100 times higher estrogen in the toenails than normal. And same, it was the same, just about the same. So
But that's
I,
all excretory. You're getting rid of it.
right, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But I feel like just my physical body, from my own experience, like the tissue is, I would just love to know if there is that much estrogen in my tissue as well, because it seems like there is to me. But that's just my own, no one cares about that.
It would be good to know. You could get a PhD there too.
Yeah. Exactly. What are your endeavors right now?
I'm continuing to work with people, and I really want to know how to best help women regain some hormone balance and then be able to get off the drugs they're on. It's not so easy. Dr. Phyllis Bronson, who's a friend of mine, they used a lot of creams in the practice that she was involved in, and she felt with GABA and progesterone, you can get off the benzos. You just don't need it anymore. But I think there's another problem, and I'm reading a book now. What's his name? He wrote Talking Back to Prozac. Peter and Ginger Bregan, Dr. Bregan, Peter Bregan. Okay, so he's written a book about getting off of the antipsychotic drugs and the benzos and stuff. But he's going into this whole you need a team to do all this, which is for emotional support. But he made up a phrase to describe that there are people that hang on to the use of the drug who it's not serving them and they're having side effects, but they think they can't live without it. And that's even if you help the hormones, we still have that brain set going on. You said the side effect of the drugs.
I mean, I get it. I'm definitely one of those people who leans towards those GABA pathway drugs, and yeah, if I always tell my husband, if I wasn't a stable person, I'd definitely be a pill popper. I definitely would like me some Xanax on the regular for sure. It's just a, and I could see why that would be addictive. It's just a feeling. It feel makes it's a GABA thing. You feel better. You feel good. You feel good in your skin, even though you're loopy, and that's it's a hard thing to break for sure. I can only imagine. Since Mark Newman has decided that his tests have shown that topical progesterone is not going to protect the uterus, I've always said to women, if your goal is because you've got endometriosis or you have fibroids or cysts or any masses, or you're dealing with clotting and bleeding and all the things that have to do with the uterus, definitely insert the cream vaginally, make the suppositories, use Onas, buy them, get them from your doctor, use Bezweken, like do it. And I think that that's a fine adjustment. I don't see a problem with people doing that at all. In fact, I always encourage it. Get it
So
to the
you'll see a
place.
little more in the test. So what? You still don't know if it protects your endometrium.
Hey, after my little battery of tests, getting all those tests, I don't even, tests are not, are just a little window into a moment in time, and it's not the full picture. And anybody who tells you otherwise is selling you, either doesn't know enough and you should turn away for that reason, or they're selling you something and it probably looks a lot like drugs. Oh, that was the question. Just because, for me, especially, I know there's a lot of women out there who just don't like the taste of the oils and they're gross.
Progesterone's
And
awful.
yeah, and I don't care. Sunflower, wheat germ, I don't care. They're all gross. And so I added on my own here at home with my own Luna oil some spearmint, and it was really nice. And it may not be ideal to put on vaginally. It might be a little tingly, but it was nice. And I was thinking the question I had was about how do you feel about women, especially pregnant women, putting progesterone in their belly button?
I really can't say, but sounds good.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah.
And then also just like because it's spearmint, it's closer do towards the uterus than, actually just taking it orally and that it might be.
When you put it close, topically, when you're closer to the organ you want to treat, the concentration of the hormone that gets into the bloodstream there is higher. It lasts for less than a minute before it goes to the liver, but you get initially a better dose right there.
Yeah, my other idea was because spearmint and mint is like a carminative herbally, and it helps reduce bloating and gas pain and stuff. And I thought, progesterone and spearmint, that might be a nice little bloating remedy for women. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
The only negative with those mint things, if you're using homeopathy, it's not good for
The
the
spearmint, the
homeopathy,
Right.
the
And
mint things.
I know women have concerns about it lowering testosterone, but literally an entire bottle, I'm putting 0.20 mLs of the spearmint in a whole entire bottle. So
Yeah.
that's like tiny amounts.
Yeah.
So I
I
don't know.
don't
We'll see
think
how it
that'd be an
goes.
issue.
It should come out very soon.
Okay, cool.
All right. Well, I'll let you know. And thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kitty. It's my pleasure.
Okay, that was so exciting. Do you not agree? Very exciting. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall and watched that that doctor walk out of that meeting with Carol and everybody. It just sounds like scandalous. But I'm sure there is much to be learned about all of this. This is why I really encourage suppositories, whether you get them from your RX or as a prescription, or you make them yourself using Onas or other creams. Now that we have the oil, the new formula, the new Luna Oil 10 has like a milky quality to it that I think with if you put it with the cream into a suppository, it's going to make for a really good suppository. And very highly absorbable. And also putting it in the belly button, the closer you can get to the uterus is important. And once again, I don't think that this information invalidates or negates the efficacy of topical progesterone. Just in our group alone, in the estrogen dominant support group, the incredible anecdotal evidence of using progesterone to protect the uterus. I mean, I personally have stories about shrinking cysts and the thinning of the lining of the uterus when using topical progesterone. And that's all I ever used in the beginning. It wasn't until I was already, later in my journey that I started to use oral progesterone or the capsules. And I have proof, that cysts shrunk, that endometrial lining, thinned out, so many things like that, experiences from women in the group, from clients of mine. So it doesn't negate the efficacy. This is just more information. And sometimes I feel like the more information we have, the more confusing it gets. But we just have to do what's right for us. And like Carol said, pay attention to symptoms, pay attention to how you feel, and keep a diary, keep a journal so you see what is helping you and what isn't helping you, and all those things. So I did look up the homeopathic remedies and spearmint, and I didn't find any kind of data. I found some people talking about that it's quite old, 150 years old or something, that when homeopathics were used, they said you shouldn't use peppermint, garlic, and coffee. But I didn't find a study. So if someone has a study for me to show me, I would love to see that because as it stands now, I could not find anything to substantiate that spearmint will negate the, I don't know, efficacy of using homeopathic remedies. So let me know. I'd love to learn that. And in the meantime, I wouldn't use Luna oil 5% with your homeopathic remedies until you know for sure. I really want to know, have your feedback on what you think of these new products. So we have the new bottles I mentioned. We have a new the droppers with the calibrators. We have the flavor, spearmint flavor, which is the new product, and then the upgraded Luna Oil 10, which I'm super excited about. And let's see what else. My Substack, please consider joining. It's free to join, but you can also contribute to the paid version, which is going to just be more in-depth information and more, podcasts. Everything's going to be on that Substack, and I'm going to post every other week on that. Maybe more often. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so thanks for joining, and also thanks for hanging in there with me through my hiatus. I know it was a long one. And hopefully, I will be back once a week as I was. All right, then. Thanks, friends.